Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He's speaking to us from Calgary. Welcome back to the show, and happy Thanksgiving to our American listeners.
Yes, happy Thanksgiving to them as well, and good to be with you again, Jim.
China's slowing economy, how much of a concern is that in the energy patch?
Well, the lockdowns now have expanded from Shanghai and the coastal cities in the south to Beijing in the north, parks and going out to any kind of social events have been restricted. People have just been told go to work and come home. You've seen the lockdowns now impact about 20% of the Chinese economy. Consumption there is down by about 3 million barrels a day. So from 13, 14 million, that's a significant percentage. And then you take into account the U.S., and the U.S. is also losing consumption. I'll just read you the numbers from the EIA report that came out on Wednesday. Total U.S. demand last week was 19.9 million, down from 21.7 a year ago, so down 1.9 million. That's about a 9% decline. And then motor gasoline was 8.3 million this week, versus 9.3 the year before, down a million barrels or 11%. So we're seeing demand destruction in the United States. Now, part of that was, of course, the weather in the Northeast, which we know 5 feet of snow in Buffalo, which impacted consumption. But we are seeing for the last couple of months lower numbers of consumption this year versus in 2021. So you take the two largest economies in the world with the demand destruction of that amount, and we're talking about the price of crude oil backing off because there seems to be adequate supplies, you've got price down from say $93 at the beginning of November, and we were as low as $75 on Monday, and we're about $78 today. So I still believe we will see sub $70 oil in December. $65-$70 would be the bottom, and I think we're getting ready for a table pounding buying opportunity in the sector, which we haven't had really since March of 2020. And of course, we had two very good years. And then since then, we've had quite a bit of a correction. That you don't see it in the CNQs, IMOs, and Suncors, but on companies below that level, some are down 30%, some are even down 50% from their highs earlier this year. So there's going to be some great bargains to be taken advantage of. We're doing our webinar tonight for subscribers, and we'll be going through a list of names that we think are going to be buys and the ranges where we think the price ranges where they will be attractive to be bought. So we're heading psychologically into a buy window, and we're saying U.S. and Canadian tax law season. Remember, if you have any of the mem stocks, FANGs, or anything in Bitcoin, or Meta, you lost a lot of money in 2022. You're going to want to harvest that and clean your portfolio out, which means you're going to have to offset it by gains to wash it through for tax purposes. So the best sector that's done well is energy. So if you bought in 2020 and a stock was 2 and it's now 10, even if it backs off to 8 or 9, that's still a good profit to offset that you need to offset against the loss you have in those other sectors.
Now, going back to China, if they slow down now, how long do you think it'll take for them to recover? Because a lot of countries have decided that China's not a reliable source for products anymore, and they're trying to find other Asian countries that can produce products at an affordable price and might be more reliable.
Yeah, longer term, you know, Vietnam, you know, and South Korea and others will probably take on more of the production. But it takes time to put those supply chains in and all these, you know, the whole, you know, inputs organized in the new countries. And also, do they have the, you know, electricity grid, the transportation grid, the, you know, the ports or the air, you know, the airports for, you know, cargo. So all of that takes time to organize. In the meantime, of course, you know, you've seen these protests with Foxconn, who are making the Apple, you know, phones. And there's a lot of, you know, they're now saying the 14 Pro and others, are going to have production problems. And then, of course, the issue, of semiconductors, you know, where, you know, the Chinese government is being, or China's being, you know, not allowed to get certain of the semi chips that they need, because, the United States is using that as a competitive, you know, a target. Where they're trying to halt China from taking these semis that are for consumer goods and, you know, making small changes and using them for military applications.
Now, of course, China keeps making noises about invading Taiwan, the world's biggest chip maker. And I've heard hinted from some military sources that Taiwan has told China, you know, we've wired our semiconductor factories with explosives. You invade, thinking you're going to take over our chip production, we're just going to blow those factories up.
Yeah, but think about it, though. If they blow them up, number one, Warren Buffett's going to lose a lot of money from his Taiwan semiconductor investment. But those chips aren't coming to the States either. Yeah. If I was China, I'll take that deal any day of the week if it was a military exercise.
Plus, how long would it take China to rebuild? Not long.
Yeah, and, you know, the key thing is the people with the science and the software, and, you know, if that doesn't get blown up, or, you know, those people can then be, you know, brought to bear to create new products. So I think, you know, removing the ability to America to get it is a victory versus not only just getting it for their own purposes.
We'll have more with Joseph Schachter right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Joseph Schachter. Joseph, I think Environment Canada has said Canada's going to have a colder than usual winter. Vancouver's been told we're going to get a polar cyclone or vortex next
week.
Yeah,
vortex. I love that word.
Yeah. They've come up with all these new terms, atmospheric rivers and polar vortexes that we never heard about when we were kids. I don't know if that's just there to scare us or the science of weather has become more precise or has new terms. But we're going to have to heat our homes natural gas. What do you think that's going to do?
Well, natural gas prices are firmed up. I think we were $5.60 for AECO, and U.S. prices are pushing $7 an MCF. Again, you know, the last week's numbers showed an injection. The data, you know, I haven't seen the data for this week yet for it, but we're in the winter season now. Drawdowns, everybody will be watching. The northern part of the United States, you know, got a big cold spell here. I just pulled out the data for the, natural gas for this week, and it was down 80 BCF. So that's a big drawdown, for, you know, the first drawdown of the year. And so we're now, you know, below what we were a year ago by 1.7%. We're 3.56 TCF in storage, down from 3.64 a week ago. And, that compares to 3.63, TCF a year ago. So we're looking at the beginning of drawdowns. And of course we're going to see quite a lot more. You know, in the weeks ahead.
Now, getting into some of the hard numbers here, what are our rig counts at?
Well, the rig counts have really done well. You know, the numbers are, you know, in the States are much above what they were, you know, a year ago. I'll just pull out the numbers here. We're looking at the rig count, you know, 782 in the U.S. last week, up from 563, so 39% higher rig count. And of course, the Permian is the most active. In Canada, we had 201 rigs working a week ago, up from 167, so that's up 20%. And the rig count is up more for gas in the United States, up 54% versus 35% for oil. In Canada, it's the reverse. The oil count is up 32%, 135 rigs, up from 102, and gas rigs 66 versus 65. So there, you know, until we have, get closer to LNG Canada, and also there's been some TransCanada, you know, issues of them, you know, building some new facilities and of course plant turnarounds and stuff. So until, you know, so now that we're into winter, we'll probably see the you know, companies wanting to bring on new gas, for the high winter pricing that we see normally, you know, December, January, February. So you want the IP, you know, your initial flush production, to come on in the months with the best pricing. And a lot of companies have been talking about that in their conference calls of their Q3 results, saying they're planning to bring on more wells just, into that, flush, you know, the flush production into that high price environment.
Has Canada really missed the boat on LNG? Because Germany took just 200 days to build a giant LNG reception facility so they don't have to rely on Russian natural gas. Why hasn't Canada put the spurs to it and pushed LNG exports to Europe and built some pipelines to get it out?
Well, we got to look at two different sources. One is east and one is west. If you look at the east, the problem is Quebec won't allow pipelines through the province. They're against fossil fuels because they have a hydro business. You know, of course, it's really Labrador, but you know, Quebec controls the hydro facilities there, and so they want to protect that business because they want to provide more electricity from hydro into northeast United States. So I don't think the chance of seeing anything going on the East Coast, I think it's minuscule, unless Quebec changes its mind, which I think the likelihood of that is low. On the West, it was the issue of resolving First Nations decisions, getting the BC government on side. All of that seems to come to bear. LNG Canada will be on in late 24, early 25. They're talking about a second train, which will double the demand from 2 BCF to 4 BCF. There's a number of projects, one backed by Enbridge, Wood Fiber, one backed by Pembina Pipeline, Cedar. There's a number of others. So I think we're going to be looking at potential before the end of the decade. Production in Western Canada might be 15 BCF a day. You're probably going to see 6 to 7 BCF of incremental demand before the end of the decade. And that will be very good for Western Canada. BC, Northeast BC, we'll see a lot of business from that. And then there'll be a lot of activity, let's say, in the Montney, in Northwest Alberta, that will also flow into the LNG pipelines. We've seen Enbridge talk about expanding their pipeline system, the old West Coast transmission line system. So we're going to be seeing a lot before the end of the decade, and it looks like the BC government's on side. First Nations are seeing the benefit, and they're supporting it, especially with ownership and a lot of job creation for them. So it's becoming a win-win situation in BC, and on the East Coast, it's not in my backyard.
Now, natural gas used to be considered a clean energy source. Environmentalists say, oh, but look at the methane leaks along the pipelines. All those leaks, satellites have proven, are in Russia. So, again, getting away from Russian natural gas is good for the planet, I would think.
Yeah, and you know, the industry in Canada is doing a lot towards, resolving the methane issue. It's all part of their ESG, guidelines and workload that they've got. So the industry is responding. Pipe is being reinforced and covered. Compression facilities they're doing things to control the methane there. And so I think that, you know, Canada is probably a leader, in terms of the environment, and doing the right things, and the companies are spending money for it. And then in the United States, they're also doing it to some extent, not as much, I think, as in Canada. And then, you know, as you said, Russia's not really doing anything. And then, you know, you go to Qatar and, you know, a number of other countries which are big natural gas producers, and they're really not doing much at all. So, you know, and then you see all these issues of methane from cows, you know. People are saying, okay, Australia's got a problem, and anywhere else where you have large cattle herds, the United States, I don't think there's anything technologically you can do there. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, North America used to be covered by herds of millions of buffalo, and Africa had herds of millions of animals. Nobody was concerned about them. And we, you know, are trying to bring those herds back. Also, what I'm concerned about too, a move to hydrogen. Hydrogen, when it burns, produces heat and water. Water vapor captures heat a lot more than CO2 does. Could too many hydrogen vehicles be a threat to global warming?
Well, I think we also should remember something called the Hindenburg. So I think that there's, you know, security applications. Do you want hydrogen vehicles parked underground? So I think that there's going to be some safety issues. Also, you know, to create hydrogen, you're putting in a lot of fossil fuel to create it.
Yeah.
And then you put it into, you know, hydrogen buses and, you know, vehicles, trucks, whatever. The inputs are, you know, while the hydrogen can get very good, E-scores, from the environmentalists, the input cost doesn't get the same kind of review, and people realize, oops, this is not what we thought. It's just like, you know, people looking at electricity for EVs and then realizing that in many countries the electricity is created by lignite coal, which of course is the environmentally dirtiest, and, you know, sulfurous lignite is probably the highest, carbon and other effluents that come out that are dangerous to the environment, and yet because it's electricity going to an EV, it's good. Nobody talks about where the electricity came from, and I think that's a serious issue. And, you know, China and India, you know, have massive percentages of their electricity coming from coal even today, and they're still building a lot of more coal facilities. So, it's like, you know, we look at the agreement of what the OECD and the developed countries are going to do. And then, you know, of course, China's still put in the emerging countries list, as is India. And of course, they don't have the same requirements for 2030 and 2040 goals as the developed countries do. So to me, that's idiotic.
I think if a country's advanced enough to make atomic weapons, they're advanced enough to look after modern energy efficiency.
Yeah, and take China. China's, EVs, they have the highest, 40% of the world EVs that are purchased in the world are there. The largest, and they produce, 60% of the EV batteries for the world. So, you know, they're at the leading edge, and yet they're not being forced to take the same discipline as developed countries, and yet they are the most developed and the newest technology that everybody wants to move to.
Well, it was only in recent times that Canada stopped sending foreign aid to China.
Yeah, and the Western Pearson, vision of the world Trudeau still seems to have.
Now, next year, are we going to see $200, $300 a barrel oil?
The only way, I think that I'm very bullish on oil for the next, 5 to 10 years. And I think that, once we get past this recession, and I do believe we're already in recession in a number of countries. I believe the U.S. is in recession. UK, the Bank of England, and the government, the new prime minister has said they are in recession. I think parts of Europe, Germany, and others are in recession already. And I think the recession lasts maybe the second, third quarter of 2023. But I think as you head into 2024, I think we'll see prices of oil come from sub 70, in the next few months, pushing 80, 90 by the end of next year. And I think we will be north of 100. The only way, I think before the cycle is over, 26, 27, 28, whenever, we'll be above the 147 that we saw in June, July of 2008. But I think the only way you get to 200 plus is if we have a major disruption in a supply, a war event, impacts, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or any of the large producers, losing a million barrels a day from Nigeria is not going to do it. Losing 500,000 barrels from Russia because the 2 million barrels they might have sent to Europe are now going to China and India. So the only way you're going to do it is if a major OPEC producer has their oil totally shut in. Anybody over, let's say 2-3 million barrels a day would be of note, and that could drive prices up north of 200 for the time. If you remember, like when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, we had a very big quick spike in the price of oil, not to the levels we are now, but it was like a double or a triple very quickly. But then once it was clear that Saddam Hussein and Iraq was going to be pushed out of Kuwait, you saw the price of oil back off very quickly, to where it was before the invasion.
Also, it's one of the reasons why oil spikes when there's a conflict is not so much that there's been a cut in supply, but that the shipping companies have to pay so much more for insurance in case one of their ships gets torpedoed or something.
Yeah, that's the issue that's going on now with Russia. If you're looking at this price cap that they're talking about, is it going to be 60, 65, 70? You're seeing different numbers. They're going to allow, if the price of that crude is sold at that level or below that level, then you can get insurance from London, the London insurance exchanges, and you can get it, and you can use ships that are from the OECD countries. But if the price is above it, not. But what's interesting is China and India and Russia are using their ships, and China and India are insuring, so they don't care whatever the EU and NATO and these other countries come up with. It's going to be more impacting, let's say, the African countries and others, where they still need Russian crude. But again, if they plug a number of 70 as the threshold for Russian production to get access to the insurance and shipping, that may end up being the price cap for oil, and that might be how it gets below $70, because, with a surplus of oil heading into recession, and then you have this price cap at, let's say, 70, then all of a sudden Russia can sell whatever they want, which means that there's no supply problem, and then that becomes the price, upside for some period of time until the recession is over.
What's the job situation in the Alberta oil patch?
Oh, there's a shortage of workers, and so they're going all across Canada. The key thing was that, they didn't have enough hours to so that the people could make a very good living. That has been, the hours now are much better because the rigs and the frac crews are all working, almost 24/7. So you have your 8 hour window of work, and then there's three teams that work on the rig or work on the frac fleet, and they're bringing in more people now from Eastern Canada, and a lot of the work is happening in the Montney, which is of course in near Grand Prairie, so people can go home at night. So if you have your shift and your shift is over, you can go home, and versus staying in a camp. That used to happen years ago, or if it's, if the work is near Red Deer, or other major, centers, being home at night really makes the quality of the job, better. And of course, these jobs, a lot of them, six-figure incomes.
Do you think they'll ever develop the oil sands at Peace River?
Again, there's a number of issues. The first one, of course, is, the capital costs are very, very high, and of course they've gone much higher than they were for the projects that are currently in existence. Second, of course, is the environmental issues, with the federal government's, and the federal government approval process. And then the third is local buy-in between First Nations and local communities. To go and do a greenfield new build versus, an expansion, is going to require a lot of homework and tens of billions of dollars. So my guess is that unless we see Canada's policy change and we become a producing country from a security of supply and the federal government takes a different approach. And of course, the industry, as you know, is trying to work together on carbon capture, and all the big companies are all involved in it. If that proves to be a success, and the industry all of a sudden goes from being tainted as the bad boys of fossil fuels to responsible producer fuels with the ability to capture the carbon, then we could see something maybe at the end of the decade. But to hear of something in the next 2 to 3 years, I think, is a very low probability, lottery-style probability.
Yeah, my opinion of DiCaprio, who decries the Alberta oil sands as a polluter and then travels around the world in a super yacht that burns between 300 and 600 gallons of fuel an hour, followed by another yacht full of models that's burning 300 to 600 gallons of fuel an hour.
And how did he fly from place to place in a private jet?
Yeah, I'm sure the
hypocrisy is obscene. And yet they seem to still get the media attention. And nobody asks these other questions of, you know, when you go to, you know, any of these conferences around the world for, you know, the pollution, like the one that they just had, you know, COP27, you know, okay, guys, you know, how did you get there?
And if they wanted to conserve energy, why do they have to make those giant blue-green screens and so on to deck out the place for the conference? Why not just leave it au naturel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joseph... It's like, listen to what I say, not watch what I do. And the hypocrisy between the two is the 180, you know, degree difference. You know, it is something that needs to be called out, but the media, you know, doesn't seem to want to do it. And, you know, if it comes from right-wing media, then of course it's denigrated because it's right-wing media.
Well, that's the problem when media starts to politicize itself. Instead of just tell the truth, guys, they all have to have a left-wing or a right-wing angle. How about just present the facts and let the people decide?
Yeah, well, but again, that's... you know, you've got, you've got, let's say the Canadian media, you know, is got to toe the line of the liberals. In the States, you've got everything from left-wing media like the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos. But then you've got Fox, which right now is becoming anti-Trump, but is very right-wing. And, so, you know, it's very different from what you would call an independent press.
Joseph, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
Yeah, I think for everyone related to this economic issue, the U.S. Railway industry in September, Biden, because he didn't want to see a rail strike during the midterms, which of course might have cost him the election, in the first week of December, a number of the unions have voted no to the deal. So between now and December 4th to 9th, if a deal does not get done, the unions have the right to strike. Biden, of course, his big support base is union, so to stop the unions and order them back to work would go against what the unions want. So we may be looking at a severe strike. 37,000 employees in this one union would strike, and the other unions in the rail area have said they will not cross the picket lines. So a disruption of all of the rail system in the United States during Christmas would be severe on the economy. And people who use rail, you know, the passenger side, if those railways are also carrying freight, they won't be able to use them. So people who are planning to travel by train, especially in the northeast of the United States, won't be able to. That will be a severe disruption. That will impact the U.S. economy significantly, supply chain, delivery of everything in stores. So I think that's something to keep an eye on. And if it looks like that's going to come, then, you know, make sure we may see the runs on toilet paper and other things at the supermarkets in the States, not so in Canada, because CN-SCP won't be impacted, but it'll definitely impact, supplies in the stores in the United States, and also, you know, access to things. The only ones who may benefit might be Amazon, because FedEx and UPS. Because they'll be busy doing a lot by plane.
Yeah, I'm lucky that a major toilet paper factory is about 10 blocks away from my house.
I don't think we need to worry in Canada, but again, if we do get a lot of produce from the United States, think about all the fruit and vegetables. We do get a lot from now from South America at this time of year, but we still do get quite a bit from the States. And, you know, lettuce and other things have been impacted already. So I think people need to be aware of that, that if the there's an announcement of a rail strike in the States, you may want to shop on those things that you do need. You may want to buy, you know, frozen stuff, you know, frozen beans, frozen whatever, fruit or whatever, and just make sure you're stocked up in your freezer of the ones that, you know, might not be available in the store, as we found during the pandemic.
And are railways not the most fuel-efficient, energy-efficient way to move products?
It is, you know, it is. And, you know, you look at the size of the trains now, you know, you've got locomotives in the front, locomotives in the middle, locomotives at the end, and they're, you know, they're taking, I don't know, 100 cars. You know, the efficiency of the rail system is definitely one of the things that we've noticed in the last 10 years that has changed. And, you know, the workers there get very high pay. The issue in the States was some pay, working conditions and lifestyle, i.e. they want to get home at night.
Joseph, thank you so much for chatting with us.
My pleasure as always, Jim.
My guest has been Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report, online at schachterenergyreport.ca. His new report is out today. He was speaking to us from Calgary. If you have any questions for Joseph or any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at @HowStreet. Twitter's still up as far as we know. You can also find us on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.